You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Brookings Institution event. The title of this webinar today is How Can We Alleviate Racism and Systemic Inequality by Expanding Broadband During COVID. And I'm really happy if you decided to join us this afternoon, because I think that we are all sensitized to the fact that we have to do something about racism and systemic inequality. It's no secret that for decades, it's the transatlantic slave trade that Black folks in this country have been subjected to, the type of oppressive systems that continue to generate inequality. And I'm so glad to be joined by three folks that I consider to be friends, mentors, leaders in this space. You know, some of you may be just taken aback by the fact that we're putting broadband next to systemic inequality, but I'm here to tell you, out of the host of inequalities that people of color are dealing with during this pandemic, it has been amplified that without connectivity, without a lifeline to some type of broadband, you are essentially silenced in your ability to get into the debates around ways to improve upon quality of life. So I'm hoping that today that you're going to learn a lot, but you'll also come up with some questions that we can ask our esteemed panel. If you have questions for this conversation, please tweet it to Expand Broadband, hashtag Expand Broadband, or email it to events@brookings.edu. Let me first introduce who has joined me this afternoon, and then I'm going to jump right into questions so we have a lot of time for discussion. I don't know which way and which direction you see in them, so I'm going to start with the gracious young lady, Kaya Henderson, who you all know as the former D.C. Chancellor of Public Schools, and she is now the CEO of Reconstruction. And I'm so happy to see her on Zoom, because every time we meet up, we are in some other country. So Kaya, so good to see you, and I look forward to hearing from you. Below Kaya is my dear friend, my dear mentor, my guidance counselor when I have to deal with the trauma of racism and trying to understand how to get out of it, is Mr. Mark Morial, who is the president and CEO of the National Urban League and the former mayor of the New Orleans, city of New Orleans. Thank you, Mark, for joining. And I know you're busy, so thank you for being here. And last but certainly not least, because I got to deal with him every single day, is Dr. Andre Perry, who, by the way, just wrote a fantastic book. He is a fellow in the Metropolitan Program here at Brookings, but he just wrote a great book called Know Your Price. And it's really looking at the devaluation of Black communities from property to people. And I'm excited that he's actually joined me in a conversation on broadband. So I think this is going to be really fun, Andre. Thank you for being here. So Mark, I'm actually going to come over to you first. And I really want to speak to you because I didn't plan this. The National Urban League just released their signature State of Black America publication. I was a participant last year. It's called Unmasked. And really, it's this evolution and this organic commentary, somewhat scathing at that, as to what has happened when we look at African-American people during this pandemic. I would like you to just start, because I think we have to start somewhere. And for the interest of time, we're not going to go back decades, but I would like you to sort of bring us to why we are looking at systemic inequality, particularly for among African-Americans, the way that we are now during this pandemic. So Mark,
thank you. And Nicole, thank you very much. And I want to thank Brookings and certainly thank Drs. Henderson and Perry, as well as you, Dr. Turner Lee, for all of your incredible work and for being great, great thought leaders on issues of equity in American life. Let me begin by saying the State of Black America report circa 2020. The statistical index was actually put together before the COVID crisis and before the economic crisis and before the George Floyd murder on the streets of Minneapolis. Having said that, that index, which we've been tracking now for 15 years, shows Black people with a status of 73.8% that of whites. That number has changed relatively almost not at all since 2004. When we talk about structural racism, what we're talking about is that the disparities are baked in rock or baked in ice or baked in stone or baked in granite. And the relative differentials between Blacks and whites when it comes to education, healthcare, civic engagement, social justice, relative to the economy, has changed very little. Now, some numbers go up and some numbers go down, but the overall index has not changed. So structural racism, and this index tells the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth for people who are serious, not about just their best opinion, but what the facts and the numbers say about disparities and therefore racism in American life. Now, we know that COVID and its triple pandemics, the pandemic of COVID, the pandemic of the economic response, and the pandemic of racial justice, are going to make these numbers even more severe. Already, Black unemployment is approaching 20%. Already, we have large numbers of Black children who have fallen behind because they don't have the capacity or the capabilities, their families don't, to be able to connect with quality schooling online. We know that the number of deaths in this country, nearing 200,000, with some 40% of them being African-American, basically highlights, if you will, the health equity issues that we face. So once again, we are in a crisis of unprecedented dimension, a crisis of unprecedented dimension when it comes to the nation and when it comes to Black people. What we say is America caught the Rona and Black folks have caught hell.
Wow. I mean, I think that you're so completely right about that. I mean, we were, as one of our colleagues say, when white people catch a cold, Black people catch the flu. Right. And I think it's beyond the flu because we're dying at rates much twice as higher than whites with regards to this pandemic. I mean, thank you, Mark, for sort of laying that out. And Kai, I want to switch over to you, Dr. Henderson, because you played a really pivotal role, I think, as the former chancellor of the D.C. schools, where you literally, you know, experienced groups of people, Black, white, low income, high income, et cetera, different parts of the lay of space here in the district. But I know you always paid attention to equity, right? When it came to that. We're now, as Mark said, in this space where digital access to broadband, as many would commonly define it, without that, you cannot go online to complete schoolwork. And Dr. Perry and I are working on a piece together around, you know, what that looks like for Black communities. But to Mark's point, they're saying that Black kids who do not get online in the next 7 months are going to be about 10 months behind in instructional learning and cognitive development, interpersonal skills. Speak to us a little bit, and I want to go back to the topic of this, which is around digital access. When you were in that position, what role did being connected play to sort of level the playing field for students of color?
I mean, before, being connected was huge in terms of getting our young people access to lots of resources beyond their individual school walls, right? I could go on and on about that. But at this point, it is even more crucial than ever before. Broadly, African-American kids experience an achievement gap in terms of education. And so our kids were already behind their wealthy white counterparts. And now literally they don't have access to the school building. The school building is coming to you through Zoom. The school building is coming to you through asynchronous learning opportunities. And if you don't have the appropriate broadband access, you literally are denied not even an equal education, an education, period, the end. You also spoke about the social and emotional issues that our young people face. We are social people. In fact, while young people are developing, that socialization is as important as their academic development, and they're being cut off from all of that. If you add on to that, how many of our families, as Mark laid out, are suffering from the economic impacts, right? We have homeless folks who, you know, there are too many people, in fact, in a shelter to be able to get your young person on a device, even if you had it, to be able to do their homework. They don't have safe spaces. They don't have, or just families, big families, multi-generational families, where our young people don't have the peace and quiet that they need, or somebody who can help them log on. What are we doing about our babies, our kindergarten through our second graders, whose fine motor skills are not even developed enough to be able to log themselves on, right? We are talking about a massive educational gap across the country, for real. But frankly, we're going to catch the flu on this one. We have already caught the flu. We're talking about kids who miss the next 7 months. What about kids who miss the last 7 months? These kids have been disconnected. There was an article about Los Angeles Unified School District in the spring where 40% of their students had not logged on. They don't know where to find those young people, right? Mm-hmm. So if we have kids and families who are not logging on, in fact, there's a really great article in the Washington Post today by Perry Stein, where she illuminates all of these issues and effectively says what I'm saying, which is broadband is necessary, incredibly necessary, but not at all sufficient.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I think I want to stay where you're at. Another statistic that, or another framework that I've actually was exposed to is virtual truancy. That is now projected to hit African-American students because just a couple of months ago, a 15-year-old student was arrested by a judge for not logging on as part of the requisite of her schooling and her parole. I mean, this is out of control, right? When we begin to think about what this pandemic has done to highlight this, and I like what both you and Mark are talking about, but also what it's actually doing for the long-term consequences of getting our young people employed and dutifully placed in our society. So I want to come back to that in just a moment. Let me give Dr. Perry a chance to sort of respond. I mean, we're talking about the devaluation, Andre, of people. Let's start talking about the devaluation of institutions. I mean, I know you speak a lot about the fact that, you know, Black businesses, Black housing, all of that creates sort of Black community life. And now we're in a state where the pandemic has challenged that. But I mean, what, nearly half of Black businesses have been wiped out during this pandemic, suggesting that we're going to see a whole lot of vacant signs throughout our community. Speak to us a little bit about how that ties into sort of your book title of Knowing Your Price, as we start to alleviate and look at broadband's role in curing some of these ills.
Yes, well, thanks for having me. And I want to thank Kaya and Mark always for their thoughtful remarks. Let's be clear that Black institutions, including schools and neighborhoods, are treated like Black people. And so when we should not be surprised to see that school districts that have a significant number of Black students also do not have the kind of access to broadband that they need. They do not have the software and hardware that they need, because it's also connected to the larger structural issues that Mark pointed out. We are more likely to be in substandard housing, crowded in substandard housing. So when we do have to use broadband, we'll have slower speeds, more people on it. I mean, just in my family alone, between my wife and child, we take up a lot of broadband. I got to wrestle the games away from him just so I can have this. But can you imagine if you don't have the resources to pay for the additional speed, it's going to be tough. In addition, this is the moment where you're seeing billions of dollars let out by the federal government. This is the time to build the capacity for the ed tech knowledgeists to develop the kind of software that schools need. It's the time when schools can build capacity to do some of the things. And let's be clear, it's been revealed by this pandemic and when it comes to technology that broadband is in reality a public utility, and we should treat it as such. It is as important and universal as highways and parks, and we cannot feasibly educate all students if we don't have free access to broadband across the board. And you state this all the time, that infrastructure breaches is the very definition of structural inequality. If you have not access for one family and you have access for another, you right off the top have an inequitable structure. So when we start to value Black people is when we'll start to see companies give their resources to make sure that every child in this, in America, has access to the tools they need to learn. I would just want to piggyback on Cheryl Eiffel of NAACP, LDF. She said that we must demand that companies provide those broadband access that our students need. If they need it now to learn, then we cannot continue to hoard those valuable resources because learning is at stake.
Yeah, and I want to jump in there too, and I'll do a shameless plug. I'm working on a book on the U.S. digital divide that's based on a 7-city tour around the country. I mean, I think part of the challenge of what we're talking about today, alongside other inequalities, is the fact that the digital divide didn't show up with COVID, right? It's been around for decades. We've not paid attention to it in the way that we should. Broadband has typically been number 7th on the list. Now it's number 1 because we have to be delicate in the care of ensuring that everyone has a lifeline to some type of access to perform the daily diligence of, to do daily diligence of just basic functions. The challenge though, Andre, when we started talking about utilities, Flint didn't really handle the water of our people too well. I'm not sure if I want it as a utility versus something that becomes more partitioned out to areas that we care about. There is no reason that there are kids in today's society that do not have broadband simply because of where they live, how much money they make, or their parents' ability to afford a device. Which, Mark, I want to go to you because years ago, the Urban League did a digital equality index. And so I kind of want to unpack this around sort of taking what everybody's talked about and share what was part of that equality index. I remember years ago when we first met, you guys were sort of putting that together and how we've seen that equality index really not meet the goals of what closing the digital divide meant then, right, compared to now.
Sorry. Thanks for the question. When we look at broadband inequality, and we look at it in its most real terms, and our digital index was about this, we look at a combination of things. One, whether there is broadband connection in the home. Number two, is there a computer in the home? Connectivity is one thing. The second thing is you've got to have the equipment, the hardware with the software to take advantage of broadband. Thirdly, do you own a mobile device or a smartphone? Fourthly, what is the percentage of African Americans who work in the technology industry? Fifthly, what are the economic opportunities for Black-owned businesses in the tech and telecommunication space? So our index showed wide disparities. Now, Black people, less likely to have broadband connection, less likely to have a computer and the phone, but over-index on ownership of a smartphone. Substantially under-index when it comes to jobs at the 4 leading Silicon Valley-based technology firms, and that's Google and Facebook and Amazon and Twitter, 4 that sort of are well-known, large, ubiquitous firms. So this index demonstrates, and I think we have to understand the divide in its broadest terms. It's 1, is there broadband connection? 2, do you have the equipment? 3, it's about the phone. One thing we also have to evaluate is, if you have the equipment, do you know how to make full utilization of it? Which is adoption. Do you know how to use all the bells and whistles on it? So I think we have a broader issue in America today because broadband is like electricity. Andre talked about it being like roads and water. It is so fundamentally essential that we can look at you or I, and we have multiple devices. A computer at home, a computer at work. In COVID, I might have 3 to 4 phones, using them for different purposes, using them at different times. So we have to talk about this in the broadest sense. And so one of the root elements of the digital divide is economic inequality, depressed earnings, income inequality among Black people, because Broadband, number one, is not free. Even if you have it, you need a device. You have to pay for the software. The smartphone isn't free. The service on the smartphone isn't free, certainly. And in a house, in a COVID environment, it may not be good enough to have one computer because you may have multiple people. Someone may be home working from home. Two students may be trying to go to school from home. So you may need multiple devices, laptops, tablets, in addition to, and therefore you need stronger connectivity in the home than you would need if there was only one device in the home. So this is a really important issue, and COVID has put a light on it. COVID has unmasked the digital divide. But here, the most tragic element of this is the impact that it will have on our children.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think it's going to be, Mark, to your point, and just again, pushing my book content again. Yes, we do at Brookings, yeah, pushing our books, right? Beyond Next Spring, Brookings Press, right? But I think part of what I found
Andre's
in my work.
Got a book, you got a book, I got a book.
You know what I mean? Dr. Henderson?
Come in.
Love all these black people with books. I love it. So one of the things that I wanted to actually just talk about, because in my book, I actually talk about this other America, Mark, to your point. And Andre, a lot to your point, right? How do you begin to look at the digital divide less as a binary construct? Who has access? Who doesn't? Who has a device? Who doesn't? Now, before COVID, you couldn't get an Uber unless you had financial collateral, unless you lived in a certain neighborhood. And now we're actually seeing, you know, the expansion of broadband go to other things where we're seeing, you know, big tech companies surveil and profile. I mean, I'll go to you, Kai, first. Then Andre, I'm going to come over to you because I think this actually ties into your work on black tech startups and sort of how do we look at the assets within to create. Kai, when you think about the extension of broadband in the school setting, I can't tell you how much I wake up in a hot sweat thinking about Brown versus Board of Education and the fact that our kids are going into environments, virtual environments, without many of those things that Mark outlined. They're not going in with a tablet. They're not going in with broadband access. How do we begin to level the playing field so that we get schools to sort of address the equity concerns up front? Because we're seeing about 60% of large school districts going all virtual. And for the last 4 months, they weren't really doing a good job in closing the divide among black and brown children.
This is not a school's question, right? Schools cannot solve this problem by themselves. I'll give you a small example. When I was in DC Public Schools, when we deeply looked into why our most truant kids were truant, when I sat down and talked to our most truant kids and asked them, why don't you come to school, you know, 50% of the time, what we came to realize was that half of them, their bus passes were running out of money halfway through the month. And so it wasn't a will issue. It wasn't a whatever dereliction issue. It was a transportation issue. And we firmly believed, we made a commitment. This was under Mayor Bowser at the time. We made a commitment that transportation should not prevent any kid from going to school.
Right.
And so we as a city decided to make transportation to and from school free for our young people, that their student ID could get them on and off the metro and the metro bus. I couldn't do that by myself as chancellor. I had to have the mayor working with me. I had to have Metro, in fact, think about reduced rates and what that might look like. I needed the city council to put money up to be able to do that. I needed people in communities to help coordinate and figure out the routes that we needed to beef up. A whole city, a whole municipality, I will say in this United States, a government needs to decide that this is the bare minimum that we are going to provide for our students. At this point, a laptop and broadband is the same as having a piece of paper and pencil. It is the same as having a roof over your head and a door to walk into. Our kids do not have a door to walk into on education if they don't have the devices and the connectivity in order to access this. And so until this government decides that it's going to care about, this is not, I mean, this is acute for Black people, but this is actually all of our young people, right? And as I look out in my work around the world, let me tell you something, other countries are figuring out how to do this because other countries understand that if they do not do this, their children will be behind in the global intellectual race. We don't care. We're happy to let our kids fall backwards, right? That cannot be the case. We as a people have to decide that American kids are going to be able to be well-educated and compete, and that the lowest common denominator is having a device and having broadband, period, the end. And here's one other thing that I will tell you. What I love about Black people is we know we can't rely on government, and so we come up with our own solutions. I want to point you to the Oakland Reach Hub in Oakland, where a group of Black and brown families were like, look, school is not doing it enough for our kids. We are going to figure out how to get devices and broadband for our 250 folks. We don't think that school is offering enough. And it was because the superintendent was embroiled in some battles with the teachers union about what could and could be taught. These families said, listen, our kids can't wait. And so they created partnerships with content providers, and they ran summer programs where their kids were in school online from 8:30 to 4:30. They had academics, they had extracurricular activities, urban farming and martial arts and things that were important to us. And so I'm watching communities come together to figure out what the answers are. Our community shouldn't have to come together. Our federal government, our state governments, our municipal governments need to prioritize this and get to it.
Yeah, and Andrea, I know you have a background in education too, so you know I'm not gonna let you not say anything. And so if you wanna add to what you've been hearing, please do.
I wanted to co-sign everything that Kaya said, because there's a lot of conversation about community schools and the power of schools, but schools are just part of a community. And I say this all the time, that kids don't live in schools, they live in communities. And the lack of broadband, inadequate transportation at times, a lack of jobs, and that all comes from the same problem. And there's a lack of infrastructure on a number of issues. And we've got to figure out ways to invest in the assets in Black communities. I just wanted this to add one thing to this conversation, that all this online learning poses an opportunity, though, particularly in the summer months. When we get a vaccine, we should, in particular, during the summer, have robust online programs for children who don't have access to the camps and so forth. Now, I'm a big proponent. I want to see school districts be able to offer camps and services. But this is an efficient way to make sure kids have the summer learning that many, we talk about summer learning loss all the time, summer melt, all these different terms. Technology can fill that void. So if we can get past this point, get a vaccine, we should learn from this pandemic and adopt some of these technological tools to advance learning moving forward.
No, and I agree. I mean, part of it, Andre and I are going to be putting out a piece around the community at school. You know, part of what we're experiencing right now, and I have the fortune of working with the Bishop T.D. Jakes Foundation, who actually deployed a STEM camp, highly successful, what Kaya is talking about in Oakland. We're seeing these examples of people rising to the top. But I think to the point that's being made, we must do a better job with universal service in this country. We are not tending to those who need the most when it comes to this. It's shameful that this country did not pass a latest stimulus bill to actually invest in schools, because you got superintendents who are becoming the broadband champions. And that's not what they do. They are there to educate our children, not to figure out how to build wireless mesh networks around their school. And so I think Kai, you're right on when it comes to the commitment of federal government to be involved. Mark, did you want to jump in as well?
Yeah, I wanted to say, so Andre made a great point and Kaya made a great point. I want to tie the two together.
Yes.
Kaya talked about how much of what she was able to do as chancellor in D.C. required the mayor and the city government and the cooperation of other, if you will, local government agencies and other political leaders. Andre spoke about how children live in communities. They don't live in schools. The larger lens that we're faced with, and I was listening to the conversation about Baltimore, is that our cities, our urban communities have been victimized by a consistent pattern of disinvestment, which has accelerated over the last 20 years. If you compare 2000 to 2020, and you look at indicators, there's been both public and private disinvestment in the overall infrastructure of most of America's urban neighborhoods and most of America's urban communities. So what this speaks to is what we need. And what we need is not simply another COVID bill. What we need is a broad reconstruction and rebuilding plan. When Congress talks about infrastructure, the National Urban League says there is no infrastructure plan if it does not include school buildings, community centers, health clinics. There is no workforce plan if it doesn't include summer youth employment opportunities for our young people. There is no infrastructure plan if it doesn't include broadband expansion with a focus on those underserved neighborhoods and those underserved areas. We've got to shift the conversation to what we need, what we demand, and what we want. And what we want is a broad rebuilding program. The current president of the United States put on the table in 17 and 18 a tax cut plan that had a 10-year price tag of $2 trillion. Imagine if instead of $2 trillion on tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, $2 trillion would be invested in America's urban communities, in Baltimore and New Orleans, in Boston, south and west side of Chicago. We've got to start talking in terms of what the remedies are, what will rectify this, what policies, and certainly, local governments have to do their part. State governments in many places have been absent. They've got to be involved in this. But we are paying the price for the disinvestment across the board in America's urban communities, in America's Black neighborhoods, in America's Black communities.
Yeah, I mean, if you were out there tweeting right now, that is a tweetable moment. We are paying the price of that type of disinvestment. And over the weekend, I had an opportunity to listen to a panel about some of the same issues. And there was something that a young sister at Princeton said, that we're also paying the price for the dismantling of public welfare infrastructures that have disproportionately impacted communities of color. Lack of investment in schools because we want to fund more police stations. Lack of investment in infrastructure because we're looking to fund other things like tourist attraction spots. I mean, Kaya and Andre, how do we get to this point where is somebody is listening right now that has their pen on policy? What would be your recommendation? Because as a person who focuses on tech policy, I tend to be in the tech policy circles. I like to broaden the debate. I'd like to broaden the seats to bring these types of inequalities to those conversations. So what would be a recommendation in terms of a policy? Andre or Kaya?
To Andre. No, I'm going to kick it to Andre first because schools are just the stage on which all of society's ills play out, right? And so there is housing policy that needs to be addressed. There is workforce and job policy that needs to be addressed before we even get to education policy, but we rush right to education. How can we fix the schools? How can the schools do it? So tell us, Dr. Perry, what policy should we be pursuing?
And I say this all the time, that the schools predominated by people of color get $23 billion less than schools with predominantly white children. And that's because we have a system that is partially funded through property taxes, creates significant infrastructure differences. We would not be, rich suburbs are not talking about this problem. Wealthy cities are not talking about this problem. But it is a problem because there's been policy violence leveled against Black people and Black communities for decades. And so if you want to address this issue, we do need different state funding formulas. In addition, like I said, for me, broadband is not a school issue, but it is amazing how Detroit Public Schools found a way to give out 50,000 laptops, and I applaud that effort. But if they didn't have those laptops, if they have them now, why didn't they have them before COVID? You know, as Kaya said, this is just basic equipment. And so if we're saying schools aren't, they don't have basic equipment, then we need to fund schools so that they can have the basic tools that they need. But broadband for me is a public utility issue. I mean, it's clear we cannot function without subsidized, high quality broadband that is accessible to everyone or a good part of the country, which it is uneven right now. In addition, we do need schools and jobs to provide technological equipment. So for me, but going to schools, I just think the real problem is school funding and how that infrastructure problem exacerbates inequalities, not just in broadband, but in after school services, in the kind of laboratory equipment you have. All those different things are reflected in just uneven funding for schools.
Yeah. Mark, did you want to jump in?
No, I think it bears a lot more conversation about the school funding system, which relies on property taxes, which in and of itself creates inequities. But let's think about it this way. School 48 of the 50 states in the United States have state constitutional provisions regarding a right to education. And what we need is we need to really a frontal assault on the system that produces the inequities that Andre talks about. I have always believed that you can't measure outputs without measuring inputs. Mm-hmm. So while people want to measure outputs, okay, let's measure outputs. Let's measure graduation rates and school performance rates. We got to measure inputs. Because in many respects, we're asking schools to get more with less. And that's a structural issue. So a new movement in this country around educational advancement, educational equity, or even, quote unquote, a new definition of educational reform has to have at its base equitable inputs, equitable funding. And if the property tax system is in the way, the property tax system be damned. The states have to fund it. They can take the property tax dollars. They can supplement it with other revenues and provide funding that is fair and equitable to each and every school in a state. Look, the disparities are so bad that even in a given school district, you don't even have equitable funding amongst the schools in the school district when it comes to operating dollars or capital dollars. So this is a problem. This is the poisonous tree, this funding system, which is producing and continues to produce inequitable outcomes.
First, I want to jump in and say that, quite frankly, like, there are a whole lot of other things. So in the housing realm, right, in my ideal world, we would ensure that all kids were in some kind of stable housing. That's the priority. And if they were in stable housing, then we could ensure broadband across the board. But even if we can't do that, why can't the federal government ensure that in every federal housing project, which our taxpayers' money pay for, why can't we have broadband in all of our subsidized housing? That is doable, right? Why can't we ensure, there's a great example, Mark, of an organization that I was on the board of that works really well in New Orleans called Ed Navigator, where employers actually pay for educational consultants to work with their parent, with their employees, so that their employees can be maximizing what's happening at school. Corporations need to understand that they have an obligation to their workers to ensure that their workers' kids can be all right, right? The SEIU, you know, a union which decided our workers are only okay if their kids are only okay, and jumped into the education space. And so if we start to look at jobs and workforce development and attach what needs to happen for young people in that, then we'll get to see some different things. Healthcare, right? Like, these things are all intertwined: jobs, healthcare, housing, and education. And we just want to, you know, fix what's going on in schools. School is not happening the way it did happen. And so now we have to think about creative new solutions that bring together together different funding streams, not just the school funding stream, but how do we leverage healthcare funds and school funds? And how do we make decisions around, we're going to have a vaccine and we're going to make priorities around who should get the vaccine first, right? Put teachers at the front lines, right? You cannot open up your economy unless teachers are able to teach so that your kids can go to school and people can go to work. Stop treating this like these are siloed issues. These are all deeply connected, and whatever policies we come up with have to be policies that hit cross-cutting.
And
I think we do
need Congress to act quickly, because for every day another spending bill is not released, is another day that people are going to lose their homes. They're not going to have adequate supplies and broadband for school. They're not going to have their hazard pay, all these different things. Congress needs to act quickly. And we do need an infrastructure bill, not just because of the ultimate end product, but we need to put people to work. So this is another, when Kaya talked about this cross-pollination between sectors, we have got to see how an investment in infrastructure can be an investment in education, can be an investment in job creation. But without the investment at the federal level, because there's only so much a state and a city can do without federal resources in this regard, we're going to continue to see these divides widen, and we'll be in the same exact position when the next inevitable crisis occurs.
Right. I mean, I agree with all, what everybody Amen. Is saying, and I had to write stuff down because y'all just going so fast. I had to make sure I had my 3 points so I can move into one or two more questions before I go to questions from the audience. I mean, I think as a person who's worked in this space for 25 years, person who started out as a digital activist working in community. So Kaya, when you say, how come we're not wiring housing? Well, we asked about that 20 years ago at One Economy on bringing broadband into any new housing that was federally subsidized. But I think the challenge, you guys, that we're always experiencing is that the cost of wiring the entire country is expensive. And it actually requires an all hands on deck strategy to do that. You need government, but government is only going to get you so far. You need companies, because in many respects, broadband has been built on private sector investments. You need community organizations that can figure out how to wire that church or that rural community of 500 people. For policymakers, if we take it past the pandemic and we just take it past schools, we should be talking about a broadband new deal. Just like we're talking about the Green New Deal, we should be talking about a broadband new deal. One that actually involves the integration of jobs and training and infrastructure and use cases that can advance access and adoption for people everywhere. And we also need infrastructure and investments in local communities. Part of what happened before the pandemic is I did a paper where I discovered that even with one-to-one solutions in schools, for example, or in workplaces, people couldn't take those devices home. And so you have a disconnect between what universal service looks like. We have in this country food insecurities, healthcare insecurities, and we have broadband insecurities. And in my book, I talk a lot about revisiting what universal service looks like in this country. How do we take programs like the E-Rate program that has funded schools and revamp that to fund to the home? How do we look at Lifeline and amplify the benefit so it's not a 1986 $9.92 benefit or somewhere around there? You can't even pick up a bag of Cheetos for $9. We got to figure out how do we leverage new technologies, much like Mark said, so that we can extend these benefits, because new technology companies know how to do new stuff. And there's a way to actually bring that innovation to social service delivery.
Then I would say, hey, do you have that broadband new deal?
I'll write it up tonight. I got it in my head. I mean, I'll write it up tonight. But like, part of it is we have to think about digital justice, which I think everybody is talking about. And Andrea, again, I want to go back to this utility framework. How do we create a model that advances digital justice among people? People did not see George Floyd because they were there. They saw it because they taped it on their smartphones. They shared it with each other. So we need an all hands on deck strategy to continue to push the envelope. So we as Black people are not the product. We're part of the production of these new technologies. And I think that's the key thing.
What's funny is it wasn't that long ago. It still occurs today that there were teachers. And I was a ed leader in New Orleans. But when we talked about giving children laptops and tablets, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. There were teachers say, well, they'll mess it up. They'll break it. They can't be trusted. So I say that to say that at the end of the day, we still need to trust Black people. Because without that trust, you don't see the investment. The lack of investment is largely because folks who can invest don't trust or value Black people. And so for me, some of these divides are really a lack of we don't value Black people enough to make the kind of investments to create the kind of change and just basic tools that folks need.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, I want to start taking some questions again. I'm looking at the exciting Twitter chat. Expand Broadband is the hashtag. You have questions, events@brookings.edu. I'm going to start switching over there. But Andre and Kai and Mark, before we go into questions, I do want to segue off of what Andre is talking about. We always look at the glass half empty when we get in these conversations. For a moment, we were almost yelling like some people I saw on TV last night, trying to get our point across about how important this topic is, right? We were doing it with a smile, though, right, compared to other people that I so yesterday. But the key thing is, there is, I think to Andre, your point, there is this beauty of people who are producing and innovating within the Black community. Startups that, you know, are innovators across the country that are trying to find ways to use technology to solve their own problems. Kaya, I know you've been around the world kind of talking to people who are reimagining not just education, but just very many things using the power of technology to be that change agent. Leave us, if you would, with just some thoughts of hope, of inspiration, of aspiration, so that we can begin to start to think about what's in the future of sort of unraveling the hidden potential for us to solve many of these issues.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you all about my book, except it's not a book, it's a company called Reconstruction that is leveraging technology to bring an unapologetically Black education to our young people. Jews have Hebrew school and Sikhs send their kids to Sikh camp, and nobody is intentional about the cultural identity, developing the cultural identity of our young people in a systematic way. We need to teach our young people that math originated on the continent and teach them to use math not as drill and as skills that they're just drilling, but to solve problems in the Black community. And so we created an online platform that has a curriculum that is developed by some of the best Black educators in the country, that is liberation curriculum, to be frank. And we've recruited hundreds and hundreds of college students and recent college graduates to deliver this curriculum to young people in small groups online. So our own virtual pods, 4 to 6 kids and a tutor who is working with them, because we have to take responsibility for ensuring that our young people know who they are in the world, that they're academically prepared, that they're culturally prepared. And we launch in January. We actually launch pilot at the end of September, but we will bring a ubiquitous and universal opportunity through technology for young people to be able to access this education. And we did it through technology way pre-pandemic, because 60% of Black people don't live in urban areas. They live in the South. They live in rural areas. And we wanted to make sure that this hits every single Black child and family that wants it. We are reimagining school, later for school, been there, done that, right? And kudos to my people who are still doing that. But there are ways to work with kids out of school to be able to get them to where they need to be. And so like me and like Oakland Reach and like lots of other people, folks are reimagining what it's going to take to get kids what they need. And I think that the problem, frankly, with why we can't have education policy that fixes broadband access and all that is because we're trying to figure out how we keep doing the same thing just in a virtual context. This requires radical reimagination. We have to take all the shackles off and think, what would it take if I were responsible for my kids' education, if I had resources and I could curate a set of experiences that they would have educationally? You would choose something very different than what these institutions are giving our kids, because these institutions weren't built for us. So I'm building institutions that were built for us, by us, to educate our young people. And that is the kind of creative thinking. I mean, I've been around the world and I've seen people not allow these institutions to provide for their most precious resources. And I'm on that. I'm about that life. I'm about us figuring out how to save ourselves, because these folks have already demonstrated that they're not coming to save us.
Go ahead, Andre.
No, I was just saying you're muted.
I was muted. I know. We all messing up the mute button today. I don't know what's going on. This is what happens when you get a bunch of Black people talking about race and racism and systemic inequality.
I will add that any effort to increase broadband that does not increase jobs, opportunities, skills, wealth, then it wasn't a real reform. You know, and people know this about me. I think we have to demand that we improve in other areas than just that one. If we're saying increased broadband, that in an increase in broadband should bring an increase in Black jobs, an increase in new companies, an increase in new technologists. And so we should not look for other people to develop the Black community. And that has been the more than often the case when it comes to reform in education and technology and infrastructure. It's always folks building wealth off of the reform. And I just have no tolerance for that.
Yeah, no, I love that. I do want to go to a question, and I'll throw it out to anyone who can answer. I love what Kaya said around we tend to think of Blacks in just urban areas, but there's a lot of people in the Black Belt. There's a lot of people in my own travels during the book tour. I went to places in Alabama that, you know, the overlays of poverty and social isolation, the lack of transportation, lack of food. It really contributes to, I think, these deserts, right? And broadband, in this particular case, the good news story was there was a principal with vision that allowed her kids to transform digital parking lots into, you know, wired homes. But Kaya, Mark, Andre, what about Black rural Southern people? You know, where do they fit in terms of infusing broadband into their lives so that we can break the trajectory of poverty that is often very generational?
I'll answer just, you know, there is a perception that's created through mainstream media and popular culture that African-Americans are urban overwhelmingly, when in fact today there are more African-Americans who live in suburban America than live in urban America. And that's been a shift of the last 25 to 30 years, as well as a large, if you will, rural African-American community, particularly in places like East Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, the so-called Black Belt, Georgia, South Carolina, and parts of Florida. And we can't let them be forgotten. You know, it's interesting because people like Jim Clyburn, who's in the Congress, and a number of other, Benny Thompson from Mississippi, and a number of other Black members of Congress won't let you forget that they represent both urban and overwhelmingly urban communities made up of African Americans. And so we've got to, you know, we've got to keep that in mind and recognize that the challenges they have are similar, but the solutions, and sometimes their poverty is more severe. And sometimes the solutions are also harder to come by because they're also living sometimes in places where they have a highly insensitive local government. Think about the leadership of places like Mississippi and Alabama and parts of Georgia and South Carolina. Sometimes leadership, which is absolutely hostile to the actual needs of these communities.
What about, okay, oh, go ahead, Andre. I've got other questions, but go ahead. It'll help me.
I understand that a good 30% of Black America live in communities that are 50,000 and less. And so it's the, you know, the Wilkinsburgs of the world, the Fergusons of the world. It's the, you know, these outer ring suburbs and in rural America where you see Black towns of 5,000-7,000 deep, sometimes a lot smaller, 2,000. But we're in these areas, and a lot of times, as Mark mentioned, they're in states that do not provide adequate services across the board to rural communities. And mm-hmm. so we're there as well. And we need to have state level changes, not just changes directed at cities.
That's right. I want to throw out this question. This comes from someone from Pew Charitable Trust. The question is, and we actually haven't talked about this, so I'm going to throw it in because I think it could open up some final thoughts. As court systems have moved online, what are the justice implications for communities lacking access to broadband? So we talked about schools, we've talked about healthcare, we've talked about workforce. Let's get into criminal justice, y'all. What are the criminal justice implications if you are not connected?
I mean, but in general, if you're not connected, you're probably not likely to have a job. You're probably not likely to be connected to other institutions. So not being connected is a sign that you're not locked into the kind of activities that propel economic mobility. And that increases the amount of exposure to the criminal justice system. And if you don't have all the tools, we know that system's going to eat you alive. And so I just think that the lack of connectivity is a bad sign for a lot of reasons. And so that's how I would answer it, that question.
Well, I would say, Mark,
with connectivity,
yes.
You know, it's interesting. With connectivity, sometimes you can improve access. I'll give you an example. We do financial literacy and housing counseling. And the leader of that program here, Cy Richardson, just shared with me that the absentee rate has been a lot lower since the service has been provided online. Now, these are to aspiring homeowners. Mm-hmm. These are the people with housing. He says, you know, it's interesting. He says, because when people have to run across town, catch a bus, ride in a car, find a place to park, he said we had absentee rates. He says, now we have lower absentee rates. So people just basically have to turn on the computer at their kitchen table or in their bedroom to participate in these financial literacy, homeownership counseling classes. So I think we also have to imagine that if we got the broadband and the adoption and the equipment, and we got that right, that we could improve access to some things in a greater way because of the convenience factor of not having to transportation and parking and juggling jobs and juggling kids for a lot of folks.
And I think also in criminal justice, just to sort of go back to what Mark and Andre have been saying, you can't apply for a job in this country without being online. So the first...
Not anymore.
The first stop is actually being connected. I met a man by the name of Joseph Mulgrave, who was a day laborer who ran out of minutes halfway through the month. As a result of that, he was unemployed for 2 weeks out of the month. You know, this is the reality of what the life that we live in. This digital invisibility that people are sort of forced upon them is actually what I think everyone has been saying is a culmination of the systemic inequalities that particularly affects vulnerable people. You know, I'm running out of time, but I will throw out a couple of questions that I want you all to think about, okay? The first one I think was a really great question from Poverty Solutions Group, which is really around, you know, at the local level, where do we start? I mean, I think we've heard that you have to start with all hands on deck strategy, and you have to, this is what I love, Andre, about your book, you have to start with the assets that exist in the community and not necessarily impose these structures upon communities, assuming that, and I was on a panel where someone actually said this, that we have to put in place structures where people don't watch Netflix with their free broadband, they actually get a job. That's an outside-in strategy, and we really need to impose structures that actually bring in the community to the table. And then I want to close with this, small businesses. How do we actually energize small businesses? And Andre, I'll give you the last word on this. How do we energize small businesses to be part of the solution to help them also be engaged? This comes from another question in terms of their role in building the type of infrastructure for them as well.
Well, I'm just going to your previous question. I just want to be quick about this. If you're like me, I live in D.C., and you walk past a library on any given moment, you'll see people just hanging outside the library trying to catch some Wi-Fi. That points to the lack of infrastructure
right in
our communities. Now, for small business, I did a study where we looked at the quality of businesses, and people may be surprised of this, that Black, Brown, and Asian businesses in Black communities are actually rate higher on Yelp and then their white counterparts. Now, what's interesting about that is that there's been this myth that we need capacity building, that we need to go through some kind of budgeting course and blah, blah, blah. No, our ice is just as cold. That's what our elders used to say, that all small businesses need is investment. The PPP loan fiasco really put Black business, well, it effectually shut down Black businesses, because Black businesses, so many of us were not banked by the mainstream institutions, did not get that emergency loan. And by the time they did get some relief, many are closing. So I just wanted to say that, but quality is not the issue. It's about investment. We have the people, we have the know-how, we don't have the investment.
Okay, I got to shut you all off, or I'm going to be like a pastor that they're going to kick off the pulpit.
Thank you very much.
Right. I want to say thank you to my dear friend Mark, my dear friend Kaya, my dear friend and colleague Andre. I want to tell you all, as you are listening, Brookings does care about these issues. Why? Because we are here and we are talking about these issues. Issues of race matter, and Black lives matter, most importantly, as we try to create and craft out a more perfect union. Please continue to listen to these conversations. This is one of many that's actually going to delve into issues that affect people of color. Please pay attention to the work of our scholars, our friends who have actually joined us as well. And let's keep the conversation going. And yes, you better buy my book. It's coming out next year, and I got a solution for everybody. So with that being in mind, thank you very much for joining us. Thanks, and continue the conversation
online. Andre, Kaya, thank you. My pleasure.
Kaya.
Thanks.